these opening statements by these philosophers, some of them were diplomats, we asked them the questions what peace meant for them. This is maybe something you want to start with your opening comments. Perpetual Peace is the title of this text by Immanuel Kant. He comes up with a very peculiar concept, maybe a meaningful one for today. This is something we can discuss. What does peace mean for you? Let's start with you, maybe.
All right, so in a sense, I don't think it means a world without violence so much as it means a world with hope, so that people have a sense that they need to they have the ability to further themselves or for their children, so social mobility, so they aren't trapped within kind of the limited confines that inevitably leads to revolution. And so I say peace is like a hope for the future, in a sense, and that you have more to live for than it, to make it. It's not worth throwing your life into revolution or against another country, because you have hope that through peaceful means you can better yourself for the lives of your children.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting that you come up with the notion of revolution and hope. Are you thinking of some concrete historical moment? Or are you thinking of that any society or any could always be on the brink of revolution?
Not any society. A society like what we saw in Egypt and Tunisia recently, where it was really economic motivation that mm-hmm. fundamentally drove the people to take over the government mm-hmm. in such a society, because there wasn't political avenues for them to engage the government in order to encourage change. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were able to do it peacefully, or relatively peacefully, but it was really out of the idea that they wanted an opportunity to better their lives from really a material standpoint, in a way, and for lack of government.
What does that have to do with peace?
Well, so long as there's these countries that are essentially totalitarian in their nature, and as long as they're legitimized by international institutions like our own, mm-hmm. or not our own, but the United Nations is essentially our own,
The United Nations is an American institution.
Well, I mean, and it's not an American institution, but it is heavily American influenced.
Okay.
And kind of what we legitimize on the international stage is a country that's a country, like we give legitimacy to Iran or North Korea, neither does the United Nations. So the countries that are most risk to the United States fall generally in the same view in the United Nations. But like in the case of Egypt, if it were to take a turn towards the extreme in this upcoming case, where the people come into power and they say to the United Nations, you are giving legitimacy to the man who was controlling us for the past 30 years. It's very easy to see by how you could create a state that was no longer engaged at the international level mm-hmm. of the other. And so long as you have those dictatorships that will inevitably fall over the long term, and usually violently, I mean historically, you can't have peace. So in a way, so long as it's possible to have that sort of authority as it is in China, so long as you have economic development and so long as people feel hope for the future. But mm-hmm. when so I guess tying it back is simply about pieces. Again, it's you need to be optimistic for your own life, or at least the life of your future children.
Mm-hmm. So peace is about a hope. It's about something looking into the future, and there are obstacles on the way.
Right, right. And it's whether the obstacles that you see, like that are within your own time, if those outweigh what could be in the future, then you'll engage with what's the current crisis facing you.
Is that an assessment of our current state of affairs, or does it always need to be that way, that peace is something for the future?
I mean, I don't think that there's an example in history where you could say that there was a state in the world that, a general state of being within the world that wouldn't lead to violence. So at all points in time, there's been, at the international level, countries that are not satisfied with the status quo, or people within powerful countries who are no longer satisfied. It has inevitably led to war, either within the country itself and then at the international level as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And maybe also, as you go around the table, define peace, but then also define what perpetual peace might mean.
Okay. Well, as I was watching the video, there was a man who said something about peace as it relates to individuals, and that peace is sort of the end to the suffering of individuals, which I think is interesting and very, very true, that peace it doesn't always need to be on sort of an international level or between states. And I don't think that anyone would be able to imagine or think of a time when there had not been anyone in the world, any individual suffering, which is very sad. So I do think that peace has, you need an element of optimism and hope, as you were saying, but it doesn't need to be just between states. Individuals play a large role in what peace is and shaping peace, achieving peace. In terms of perpetual peace, what Kant says, he says it's an end to violence rather than just sort of a pause between any further violence. So I don't know if that has ever been, that hasn't ever been possible because violence is still ongoing. But I think it seems to me that because peace in people's minds has become sort of this distant kind of unlikelihood. Like people have, a lot of people have given up on the idea of peace because violence always seems to present itself throughout history, just keep reoccurring. And I think because of that, it's turned into this sort of fantasy that people just deem so unlikely that they stop recognizing, they stop associating like the true definition of peace or an end to violence with the word, and the word, like, peace has become kind of like a trend for some people. You know, like peace signs and like this, it doesn't, there isn't that association anymore with what peace actually is, just because it has become this distant thing that in so many people's minds think it's not ever going to be possible. So I think there's been a really big shift in focus from what peace actually is, with, you know, symbols of peace. There's like a large disconnect there.
So you'd say the symbols of peace, like the peace sign,
mm-hmm.
they've become sort of superficial symbols that don't
actually
have any meaning.
So how would you, maybe this is I kind of want to keep going around the table, so I'm trying to keep myself quiet, but like, how would you represent peace, if not through, I mean, how would you imagine it visually? It's easy to imagine, as in the previous workshop, there was a discussion about this, it's easy to imagine conflict and war,
mm-hmm.
right? We're immersed in it, in this mediatized environment, all too much, all too often, but like, how could we visualize peace if not through these co-opted symbolic kind of languages and forms that we
struggle? I don't know. I mean, that's a difficult question to answer. But I think there might need to be sort of an achieved stronger sense of peace before people can actually kind of move back to linking the meaning with any visual. Because right now it just kind of seems like an impossibility, I think, to a lot of people. So they just have given up.
So we don't have the wrong symbols, we just have the wrong world.
Yeah.
Which makes the symbols,
yeah.
symbols
no,
impossible.
What you're also suggesting is that the visual language by which we talk about and refer to peace actually emerge from the process of practicing it.
Right. And I think that because it's become, you know, such a trend, and like, the symbols have lost so much of their meaning, that only reinforces the meaning being lost, because it becomes so commonplace. That, you know, people, I don't know. I mean, some people who do like use peace signs, I don't know, in any sort of, actually do, are trying to support peace or achieve peace, but it has become just sort of this like fashion statement.
So they become like, this becomes a sign of the absence of peace. In a way, or a typical peace sign suggests the lack of a reality of a peaceful kind of way of living, or opportunity for a peaceful way of living.
Aaron has used a lot of symbolism for our project, using the color light blue right throughout the exhibitions and the book. Why that color?
Well, for that very reason. On the one hand, adopting the existing symbolic language and visual language of peace. So you know, the circle with the three spokes, right? And we've adopted that iconography. We've adopted United Nations blue, but we're also trying to disturb or interrupt that by always having the spokes, for instance, dispersed through the pages of the book rather than ever showing up to create a peace symbol. So we're always trying to think of if peace is endlessly deferred, if the symbolic language suggests not peace but the absence of peace, maybe what we need to do is not just completely abandon that symbolic language, it is the language we all know, but rather try to start to like interrogate, dismantle, recombine it. Blame it. Enough on my part. So, do you want to go next?
I think when we're talking about peace versus perpetual peace, I think it's important to differentiate between peace in one part of the world versus in pretty much all of society, I guess. Because, I mean, at least in my lifetime, I guess not for a while now, but when the United States was relatively at peace with other countries, there was violence going on in other countries. So whereas we may say, okay, we're in a state of peace, there's no violence, there's violence going on in other parts of the country, in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just this whole idea that when talking about peace, people are only thinking about what's directly affecting them and not the entire world. So I think perpetual peace would be a state when all countries or citizens or whatever kind of start to think more globally and kind of think about what actually constitutes peace, just going off of what you just mentioned, what Kant said, like a suspension of hostilities versus an end to all hostilities, and not just what affects them.
It's a fascinating idea. There's the German philosopher Theodor Adorno who said there is no right world in the wrong world. Yeah, so one cannot kind of imagine a peaceful world just because our country is peaceful or our limit. I mean, I come from Austria, which is not a war leading country at the moment. It doesn't look like we're going to be very soon. But it is true. I mean, since we live in a globalized world, everything is affecting everything. So even our peaceful practices in our immediate surroundings might have some impact on situations otherwise in the globe. So for you, this idea of perpetuality is actually a question of universality, which I think is a very important point and a very Kantian thought. I think Kant would not have been satisfied with having a peaceful Königsberg, which was the little city he was from, but he was thinking, of course, of Europe, which for him was almost an equivalent of the world, and we could discuss the problematic of that. But I think he was took a universalist approach and was thinking of the whole world.
Can I ask you one question? I don't mean this as critical. I just mean it as a question. Of course, it all depends on what peace means to you. But do you think of America as peaceful? Or at peace?
I mean, right now, no, I don't think we're at peace. I think our underlying motive, whether you believe it or not, is to eventually achieve peace. But I think I wouldn't really say we're at peace just because, I mean, we're going to war right now. And I mean, even though, you know, there's always talk about trying to resolve things peacefully and through treaties and whatnot, it just seems like everything always leads to just another war. But I think eventually, you know, they'll try, and hopefully there's just finally an end.
Did you recognize any of the things that Kant is talking about as being connected with the U.S. currently being at war?
I mean, I guess referring back to the hostilities thing is that it's after World War II that ended hostilities with Germany, and then that created something with Russia, which then Soviet Union, which then in turn created something with Vietnam, and then that eventually led into the whole situation in the Middle East, which brings us to today. So
all wars are in a sense connected, which is a Kantian idea as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say starting back with World War I.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. I guess when I think of peace, I think of these 6 billion people it seems like if peace had a goal, to me, the goal would be to have all these 6 billion tiny individuals in states of mental peace. And I think that that's highly unlikely right now, but I guess at any one point there are going to be a number of people within that who in their minds are nearly at peace. I mean, not personally affected by horrifying or terribly uncomfortable things. And I don't know, I guess maybe it's seeing all these circles, but in my head it's kind of like this giant circle and there are all these tiny dots and they're kind of like they glow or something if they're at peace. And it seems like there's, I don't know, over the course of time kind of this fluctuating levels of, I don't know, universal, like global discomfort. And I guess I think that in the absence of violence and the absence of war, we're much more likely to have more people really close to achieving peace, in the sense that the, I don't know, outright horror of war and violence isn't present and pressing at the windows. But I guess I don't think that any single individual can be completely at peace with anything unless everyone else is also completely at peace. And
every one of the 6 billion.
Every single one. Which is, and I don't even know if that would work, because if everyone was completely at peace, then no one would know war, or I mean, not no. I didn't mean to make war the opposite of peace. I don't know. No one would. I don't know. I guess no one would know what was other than that. So I guess it would. I think that if that ever happened, it would be one single moment, and then something would happen, and it would.
It's a very interesting proposal, and we've heard it before in previous workshops. It comes up. I think it's an interesting idea. This idea that world peace, or peace between nations, which I think is Immanuel Kant's concern in this text, has something to do with our individual mind, and not only our individual mind, but every single individual mind in the world needs to be at peace with itself as a condition for peace. I don't think that Kant would say that. Some people would go so far in previous workshops to say that it was Kant's mistake that he left that dimension kind of out. I mean, maybe we can talk a little bit about what Kant thinks of human nature. But I think it's an interesting idea, a very difficult thing to achieve, that everybody is going to be at peace with himself, whatever that means, to hope for that. But a very ambitious goal.
But you're also getting at like a dialogic definition of peace. That peace is something that is not, it's a mental state, as you said, but there's also something that exists in relationship to others, such that if somebody else is not in a state of peace, that disturbs your ability to find peace.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also something very intimate there, something mm-hmm. that, you know, students in Lahore in Pakistan said the exact same thing. So it's interesting at this moment, this desire for another more collective understanding of peace that would kind of on the one hand be very inward, internal, but at the same time be caught up in somebody else's definition or experience or life. Right? Do you want to go next?
Sure. I don't think that peace is an end to conflict. I think it requires a fundamental reordering of our conceptions of like masculinity and honor, to go off of what they said in the video. Yeah, and we have this current vision of, like, honor, which is very reactionary, which is that, like, an offense requires, a violent offense in return, and violence is the default mechanism for dealing with conflict. Those values need to be upended. I'm not sure how that would happen in, you know, given the diversity of the global culture. But, yeah.
And so what does perpetual peace mean?
With that mindset in place, war won't be the default mechanism. And it'll be replaced by, you know, dialogue.
And do you think that's what Kant was also trying to do when he was writing on perpetual peace, or do you think his project was different? Sometimes he justifies war, does the work of peace. He has such a complicated relation to war. At other times he's trying to abolish the ending armies.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely waffles. He'll talk about, how defense is necessary, and, you know, then he'll say the opposite. I'm not really sure how to answer that, honestly.
Do you guys feel like Kant is saying one thing about war, or do you feel that he's raising a variety of questions or perspectives as to how war can be defined, limited, prohibited?
I think he's definitely contradictory. He, like, he's trying to talk about perpetual peace, and at the same time he mentions just wars, which I don't think are really possible in that sense. And I think we still have this mindset today where we mix war and peace, and we wage wars in order to create peace, but really war only perpetuates war, and if you want to perpetuate peace, you have to start with peace by seeking fellowship rather than by seeking to, like, oppress people. And sort of, I think I agree with Liz that, like, dialogue is a really important part of that, and sort of instead of, like, sort of might making right and resolving differences by violence, you need to talk to people.
What if you're attacked? You're a country and you're attacked.
I mean, see, I think that's where you, like, sort of start getting into, like, really tricky situations. And, like, there have been nonviolent movements that have, like, responded to, like, violence against them by being passive, like, say, Gandhi. And that worked with, but that worked within the context of a society. And I don't think there's been any example in the history of the world, as far as I'm concerned, of a country responding to violence by nonviolence and being successful in any sense. I think they just end up getting oppressed in that case. And I think that's when you speak.
What would happen here at Haverford? What
did we get attacked?
I don't think in this age, at least if we're only talking about states, which, I mean, I guess we're not. If we're talking about states. You're not attacked unless you're perceived as threatening. That's the logic of deterrence. Actually, no, it's not. Anyway, forget what I just said. You're not attacked unless you're perceived as threatening. Of course, this is not possible. If we were all, you know, to disarm, like, everything, all the bombs, then, you know, it wouldn't be necessary.
I think it's interesting. I know two alums from one from Swarthmore from, like, 1943, and when Pearl Harbor happened, all the men of Swarthmore went out to list, like, immediately. Well, at Haverford, there was a number of conscientious objectors in addition to people who went, and then a few who stayed. But it was a very distinguished quality of Haverford about the conscientious objection, even though they both came from a Quaker tradition. Swarthmore was far more willing and ready to enlist than Haverford.
So if Haverford were to attack, it would not resist?
I think Haverford would be quite passive. I mean, I think it'd be willing to take a few blows in the spirit of Gandhi, but I don't think Haverford has it within its soul to take up arms.
Mm-hmm. Speak for yourself.
I mean, I would not. I would enlist after Pearl Harbor. There's justice to... I mean, if you hadn't, after we were attacked, there are times in the world... And you could. I think the point is about what led to those wars. So in the case of Germany, I mean, France has a lot to blame both for creating the conditions of World War I and then also for creating the conditions of the Great Depression. And between those two, there would not have been a World War II. But I mean, in the case of Japan, it was highly driven by imperialistic tradition and a desire to control not only your own land, but to make others subordinate to you, those born out of a racist and imperialistic ideology.
Okay, but let's say you are now in 1939, and now it's France did all these mistakes, and Germans were unemployed, but now you have Hitler, and you have him in the neighborhood, and he's arming and attacking and invading. What do you do?
I mean, in our current age, or with...
No, I mean, if you were at the time trying to make a decision what to do with such a threat.
You don't have the benefit of historical hindsight.
Right. No, it's really... whatever you say, half the people won't agree with you. But
it's a dilemma.
It's a very much an individual kind of... based upon your own perceptions of the world.
I'm not sure there is a way to respond to that effectively, non-violently. And if you sort of... I mean, I guess you could say, like, all right, let Hitler take over the world, and then slowly, like, within this, like, giant society that he's created, we can sort of break down the oppressive factors of it, like, through legal means, but that would be a very slow It wouldn't be very...
There would be no more Jews. There would be no more racial minorities. It would be a very peaceful society.
I'm not suggesting that, but I think that, like, brings up sort of the problem of security that keeps... like poking its head up with peace. It's like, how do you maintain that? And I think
how do you enforce it?
Yeah, how do you
secure it?
And that, I think that's like a sort of a dilemma of the UN too. Like, they don't have a standing army, so it's hard for them to enact peace in the world because they don't have anything to like enforce.
And it's not entirely true that they don't have anything to enforce. I mean
they do have mechanisms, but like, I think that's just like a common critique, is that there's no
standing UN army,
there's
or that no military forces.
There's
just,
no, and like in the conflict in, say, like Democratic Republic of the Congo, there aren't a lot of like there is a UN presence there, but they aren't able to, say, like, protect villages of women from being raped,
mm-hmm.
and like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And this is actually... I talk to a lot of UN ambassadors of the Security Council, which is the one authority the United Nations has to actually make such decisions, which actually include the use of force.
Yeah.
And that issues such as the protection of civilians is now one of the big topics that the Security Council is discussing to include in such resolutions.
Do you think this is Khan's question as well? Or do you think he doesn't go far enough?
I think Kant has sort of a very, like, he thinks about, like, nations as these set blocks, and they interact with each other, and I feel like the world today, and probably then, is more complicated than that, and you have sort of people within states that aren't, like, a nation doesn't really act all as one unit, and I don't know, I think he oversimplifies the matter in that sense. I think as long as you have, like, people, like, acting in violent ways within a nation, you can't have peace, because the only way to, you know, protect yourself in that sense is oftentimes violence.
Okay, so you're in Königsberg, and Kant never left Königsberg, so you had to go there to see him, to meet him. And you're walking with him, and he explains, as he does in Perpetual Peace, his definition. So what's yours, or what would you say to him?
Okay.
How would you explain how you define perpetual peace, or how you define peace?
I think of peace as sort of based on respect on a pretty individual level. Sort of, I think one of the problems with, like, what Sogu was saying with peace symbolism today is the idea of, like, world peace. Like, I don't think people can really grasp the idea of world peace. When you put it that way, it does seem, like, really daunting and distant. But I think that if you think of it more on an individual level and just think about, like, if people just started to respect other people, then... and treat them, you know, like Kant says, as an end to themselves, not as a means, then I think that, you know, that would really solve a lot of problems, because people are going to conflict with each other. Like, that's how the world works, and I don't think that anybody would want everybody to agree on everything, because then no progress would ever be made. But I think that if we get to a point where we're willing to say, like, we disagree, but... you know, we can both work in our own spheres. We don't necessarily have to go to war with each other. Like, if we respect each other as humans, we're not going to kill each other, because we understand that we each have, you know, these own precious lives. And, you know, we'll talk about the issues. Obviously, that's, like, very idealistic, but I just think that, you know, if we decide to respect each other, that will lead to an environment that could lead to perpetual peace, because when something does come up that would lead to conflict, we'll have sort of the mindset, the mechanisms in place to discuss it, you know, peacefully in terms of respect, as opposed to treating each other like less than human sometimes.
Mm. But is it enough to just respect each other? I mean, I might respect another person and yet fear him and be scared that he might attack me. I mean, I'm just saying, I think that you are very right that respect and trust are important elements, necessary elements for lasting peace. And Kant talks about it too. But I think he also talks about more. He talks about other set of conditions in the relations between humans and in the relations between states, which are kind of independently from the moral quality of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So even if those moral qualities of the individuals were awful and horrible, he thinks that if you have the right mechanisms in place, a more peaceful world could be reached. Do you agree with that?
I mean, that doesn't really make much sense to me, because it seems like if people don't respect others, and people don't have, you know, people have like terrible personalities, but there's this mechanism in place between nations, then that's not really peace. That's sort of like what Kant is saying peace isn't. It's just like a ceasefire between nations. The nations aren't fighting, but the people within the nations aren't at peace with each other. I think that fundamentally, if you think about it, like, why would you go and kill somebody? Like, I don't know, it just doesn't make sense. And I think that if people, you know, look inside of themselves, then that's more important than some sort of global mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Also, just like, for me, that kind of global mechanism, like the only thing that I could possibly envision that would enact that would be, like, a Hobbesian Leviathan that could, you know, just, like, keep people from fighting each other out of fear, because they had more fear of the absolute power of the Leviathan. So, and that's, like, I'm not sure that any nation would sort of, you know, and Hobbes also, like, or Hobbes Kant mentions that if you had this, like, international federation of states, it couldn't be, like, a nation with other nations subsumed underneath it. And that's really the only sort of mechanism that could, as sort of, like, a philosophy of fear, keep people in check. So I think that he kind of is
a piece of the graveyard.
Yeah, I think he's contradictory in that sense.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting point, and we can talk about maybe how then mechanisms should work between nations. I've been talking to one of your administrators here, and he told me how here at Haverfords you have this principle of consensus, that you reach decisions all together on the student level and the faculty level. I think that's a very interesting idea. It's been tried. It's a principle also in many mechanisms of international relations. Many times it works, many times it doesn't work at all. There's some mechanisms that are blocked because people cannot reach a consensus, one of them being the Security Council.
Mm.
Where, in a sense, through the veto power of the four permanent members, the five permanent members, unanimous decisions are required between at least those five permanent members, and very often they cannot agree, and therefore they don't take any action and are in a sense, blocked. But that's an interesting idea that we do not want, and Kant, I think, says that, we do not want a world state, we do not want to have a superstructure imposed on the whole world, which would then really be a terrible and awful tyranny.
Do you want to go next?
I was kind of going to say almost the exact same thing, and that I really feel like it's an individual thing. But I think it's an individual thing because Kant kind of jumps into it, and I feel like we need more time than that. And I don't know whether it's going to be our children or our children's children or whatever it ends up being, but I just feel like it's a process, and it has to start individually before it can grow into a universal sort of feeling. And I feel like getting rid of all of our armies would just lead to this sort of fear and kind of like sitting on the edge of our seat just waiting. And I feel like that fear of each other needs to be subsided individually before we can just get rid of all of our armies and kind of hope that we all individually are good enough people that we're not going to secretly have our own stash and then go to war with each other.
How is that to be achieved? Let's say even on a small level. Let's say among our group, if we all wouldn't know each other and therefore fear each other.
Or even for Kant.
How does one establish among a group of human beings the absence of fear of each other?
I think a huge part of that is education and knowledge and just getting to a point where we can mutually respect and have enough empathy for each other to truly learn from each other and maybe not understand the practices or the beliefs or the moral values of others, but to understand maybe where they're coming from and have, and I think in like a global media world where we have this access to each other, it's almost silly that we still can see people as objects to be killed and not human. So I think that a huge part of that is education and building enough respect, as you said, to actually understand each other to a degree.
But everything's been virtualized today, right? Even war is a video game for many soldiers.
Right.
So how do we cope with that?
Well, I think it's a dialogue, like Liz said, and it's just a finding a way to create that dialogue, and maybe it doesn't have to be necessarily face-to-face, but truly trying to educate ourselves and understand a culture before we invade it, or, you know, kind of just understand more, I guess that's all.
And I want to actually ask you to speak about one more thing, which is what you began with. You raised the issue in Kant of time and temporality, and you tried to translate that to your own definition. What's happening in Kant's essay on perpetual peace, which is so fascinating, is that I don't know what you think about this, Martin, he's engaging in a very complex discussion of the time of peace, right? Like the trajectory of peace, whether it's a process, whether it's a goal. It doesn't seem to be something that you reach in your own lifetime.
No, I don't think so. I think that's why education is not only within each other, but in educating our kids, because if you teach hate, you breed hate. And I think that is a huge problem, because I do feel like every generation has their own fears, and whether they know it or not, they project it onto their children. And so I think it's that individual stopping your own projections and stop breeding hate and start trying to, whether you can come to terms and understand something or not, but trying to teach your children and the next generation. And I think eventually it's a process where it is slowly diluted.
What's the time of peace, Martin, for you when you read Kant's essay?
I mean, I think when I read Kant's essay, he doesn't really make a time frame. He just says this is something we cannot really know, but we can know by his entire concept of reason and the relationship between reason and nature that it will come. And he gives examples of how nature works, and in the end works even through wars, and he sees wars as an instrument of nature, and to then in the end achieve this time of peace. I think Kant is engaged in a project, in a larger project, at the end of the 18th century, which was not thinking necessarily of a distant, faraway future in 500 years. I think the whole project of the 18th century it was very much the same spirit that led to the creation of this country, was to actually, through self-improvement, education, enlightenment, to lead now mankind out of slavery and out of war, of the calamities of war. So I mean, he doesn't give a time framework, but I see him not as somebody who says this is something not to be achieved. I think for us, we are the ones who see the impossibility of some of these things that Kant's proposed, because we look at our today's world, we think so many years have passed since 1795, and so many new problems have come up that Kant might not have even thought about.
Next?
Well, I think that perpetual peace can achieve by the fostering of intercultural communication. and that would in turn eliminate the hate and the xenophobia between people and the racism. And it doesn't just start with governments. It's very much individually based. So, I mean, the government may change overnight, and the people's opinion would come, and the people might form political groups and organizations, and they would rise up and become the government, and any peace treaty can be nullified. And as a Palestinian with an American Jewish best friend, I know the worth of intercultural communication. No peace treaty changed the idea of an Israeli or a Jew from just an idea to an actual human. But the meeting between her and me actually helped me achieve that sense of attachment to a person, that human attachment. She wasn't just a mere idea in front of me. She became a person to me. And it was the same for her. It was just an idea before a Palestinian. It was just that other side, that other nation. She couldn't, it wasn't tangible to her in a sense.
Yeah, I agree. In the essay, Kant says that democracy is enough to prevent war between states because, you know, theoretically, no one will consent, knowing, like, the full consequences of wars. But really, more is required than that. Like, there needs to be mutual respect. You know, there's pervasive racism, which I think, you know, makes it a lot easier to go into Muslim countries and, you know, blow shit up. yeah, and people need to be informed, you know, because right now we have this combination of manufactured consent and racism, and yeah, I think education is very important and also within reach.
Yeah, and I also think that if we have racist groups within a country, racist political groups, they will one day rise to become the government and to represent a people. So it should be individually based, because these things change, and it's the opinion of the street that shapes the country's stance towards another nation or people.
Can I ask you to respond to Kant's remark that, you know, that we've reproduced on the poster and elsewhere, that an injustice in one part of the earth is felt all over it? I'm interested in this quote because it seems to be associated with a cosmopolitan way of thinking that he introduces that I myself identify with. But it seems that today we're also living through a really disorienting moment when one can feel an injustice in another part of the earth but actually not do anything about it. So I was wondering if you could speak to that, maybe personally, maybe politically in relation to Palestine.
As in, can you elaborate a little?
I mean, what does it mean for us, that there is the situation in Palestinia as it is?
Like, is it enough to just feel that there is injustice in another part of the earth? Kant helps us understand how we're linked. We're bound to the same surface of the earth. But is it enough to just feel that injustice? Does it need to fundamentally lead to an action? Do you know what I mean?
So, wait, you're asking if this injustice can be felt by someone else without the human contact with another person from that country, or that is experiencing injustice, or that's what you mean? Yeah,
yes, and also that, I mean, maybe to be more direct about it, I mean, we live in a global world today. What is happening in Egypt is something that all of us at this table probably are following every day. What's happened in Tunisia is something that we've all been learning, following, and is it enough to just follow it and to feel it? Is that enough?
Well, I think the personal connection, personal attachment to someone from that region of the world is required, because otherwise you won't be impacted by it. You won't feel that there's someone you know there. You won't sympathize as much as you would when you know someone from there. Yeah.
Kant doesn't really talk about this very important issue, but he kind of, maybe in an indirect way, thinks that this, he talks about it maybe in a completely different context. He talks about commerce, that commerce brings people together, but by really physically, I mean, you, if you are a trader, you go to different parts of the world and you get to know different cultures and different mentalities. So trade and commerce brings people together. Of course, also, since there's the economic element, it links and intertwines interests of people, self-interests of people, and makes it less unlikely to go to war. What the European Union has been doing, since even though there is this great idea of having a common Europe and building up a common Europe, the Europeans, the ones that you describe as on the streets, very often don't feel that. And they don't feel as Europeans, and they don't identify themselves with the European Union. So what they have been doing, and almost every young European who went to university or to college has been part of these programs where you then study for a while in another European country just to live there for a semester or two and to be exposed, to get to know other people. Quite successfully, and if you the pro-European attitudes of those people are much higher than of the rest of the population that have never left their countries. I think this is a very, very, very important idea of what you're saying about the actual contact. Although this contact might not always be so positive. What if you meet this one Palestinian and you're Jewish and it's a bad experience, then you're going to draw your conclusions, you know. This is sometimes prejudice also arise from personal contact.
Right, but it's not just one event. You can't just say, oh, I met this person, he's bad, so it makes all of his nation bad.
But people sometimes do that.
Right, but it shouldn't be just based on one event. It should be based on a couple of events. And you were talking about Europe, and so I was studying about Germany last semester, and there are a lot of groups who are opposed to the Turkish immigrants in Germany. So when they've started talking to some Germans started talking to Turks, and they've actually changed their attitudes toward the Turks when contact was initiated, because they started perceiving them as humans and not just as an idea, just an idea.
There's also this other way that Kant speaks about intercultural communication or dialogue. As Martin mentioned, commerce can be a vehicle for cultural exchange. But paradoxically, war is also for Kant a kind of a vehicle for cultural exchange. He talks about how one of the unintended benefits of war is that it migrates populations, and in dispersing and displacing populations in the most violent of ways, it also results in a cultural intermingling. And it's, for me, it's a very difficult passage in Kant, because on the one hand, he's grappling with the world in which that is the reality as it is today. On the other hand, philosophically, he's kind of instrumentalizing or justifying war, or kind of reading in war something positive or beneficial. And I don't want to do that, you know. I personally don't want to go there. But that's a whole other way to think about what are the other ways that cultural dialogue happens, sometimes through our own agency and sometimes not at all through our own agency.
There's another interesting, strange effect that wars sometimes have. If you think of, for example, women's rights have been advanced significantly after World War I in Europe, because when the soldiers were at war, women were needed in the workforce, and that led to universal suffrage in Britain, for example, in many other European countries. It's an unintended consequence. I don't think that Kant would ever say that's why we should go to war, but he says, I think that's this idea of why can we hope for peace, because nature sometimes uses these, in a sense, negative effects in a dialectic process to a positive end.
Right. Well, one really fundamental assertion that Kant makes that I find really interesting is that war is inherently the nature of man, and that's just something very innate in him. And I think that this sort of leads to an interesting point that was brought up at the panel last night, the idea that that peace is not passive, that peace is an action, And so I guess that would lead to my definition of peace as not so much a contract as a constant negotiation and a constant willingness to be open to hearing not just alternatives to war, but alternatives to anything, which I realize is a really broad topic. But I think that a lot of peace is just openness and willingness to continue dialogue. But that just speaks to, you know, peace and, you know, temporary matters or in terms of conflict resolution. As for perpetual peace, I find it really difficult to wrap my mind around that. You know, to me, it's sort of like imagining a color that's never been seen before. Like, you imagine it's possible, but it's hard to imagine what it would be. I don't know. I really can't say.
Like a utopia. Or
yeah. I mean, anything that sounds like, you know, utopia just sounds too idyllic to be true.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think that that's where, you know, Kant sort of breaks down this the scorn that politicians have for philosophers in the beginning, because, you know, I think that from a real politic perspective, there would be the perception that philosophers are just building castles in the sky with their utopias and leviathans and constant peace.
Mm-hmm. Because he's aware of that criticism and tries to and
yeah,
therefore
I mean,
talks
he opens
about
his essay with it.
Mm-hmm. But you're using it as well against Kant in a bit. You're saying that he's actually utopian.
Oh, I definitely think he is utopian. But, I mean, on the other hand, he's not, you know, he's not a political scientist. He's a philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not so much his job to create a mechanism for creating perpetual peace. It's more important, you know, as you said in the beginning, that, you know, he sort of gives us this hope of perpetual peace, that he just sort of presents it as an option. And, you know, this leads to discussions like this where we sort of consider what that means and how that can be advanced.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that his text, if you look at it, is he meant it as this is how it's going to be and this is the solution, or is it a proposal?
I don't really know enough of the historical background behind it, and I'm sure he did have some specific intention when he wrote it, but to my mind, at least when I read it, it sounds more like a proposal.
Mm-hmm. I think there is an indication why it could be a proposal. And that is that it comes in the form of a treaty,
mm-hmm.
of a contract.
Right.
And the contract is always between people. So Kant is, in a sense, proposing us, proposing to the world of thinkers and practitioners a contract. This is something I would propose how we could agree on all together. It's a draft.
Mm-hmm.
Let's work on it. There are articles and clauses. This is my first proposal, you know, and let's all amend it and let's all change it around so until it fits. That's how I read the text as a proposal, not necessarily as a set in stone and unchangeable.
I don't think it's that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's that much that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least to some degree, maybe I'd be convinced to follow your path of thought, but you know, I don't come out as Martin does of as kind of a diplomatic way of thinking about this text and its readership, its audience. I come out of a literary approach to a literary trajectory. I teach in an English department also, so for me it's a poem that is fundamentally creative and imaginative, and the principles these articles enunciate the most fabulous ideas that, you know, there will be no standing army. Standing armies will be abolished in time. That war will be fought in ways that leave open the possibility of a future, and of an apology. These are things that, to me, in this day and age, are fantastical and probably were in his day. So I think of it as a fundamentally imaginative text and a creative text. And perpetual peace as a phrase. There are things that I think it clearly means for Kant, but I also think we can see it on the side of the imagination. You know? I don't know how you guys read it, though. How did you read it?
I don't know. I sort of took it more as like a proposal as well, and I don't think that those two views are mutually exclusive. I think you could see it as both as sort of visionary, but also as something that could be worked on, and sort of, I feel like that's, I mean, in a sense, it was sort of like the first act of peace. Like, you have to start a dialogue of peace for there to be peace,
mm-hmm.
instead of just having a dialogue of war.
Like, in other words, another way to phrase the question, is there a relationship between peace and creativity or peace and the imagination? Clearly there's a relationship between peace and dialogue. Many of you have said that. Is there a creative dimension that we're forgetting about or that we also need to talk about?
I think just in the terms of, like, imagining a peaceful world, but like Sam said, that, like, it's really hard to do that because it doesn't exist.
You're wearing this Prokofiev, like, shirt. What is that? What does that mean? Does that mean anything in relationship to this conversation? Or not really?
I mean, I guess we could talk about expatriates from the Soviet Union. I actually don't want to go there. But I don't think that creativity takes sides, really. I think that, like, breaking out of the social norms that we have currently, like, you know, like I said before, conceptions of masculinity requires creativity. But, like, achieving peace itself requires more of, you know, a willingness to subordinate one's own needs to the needs of the community as a whole. And that, like, that requires, I guess this is also creative, like, a changing perception of what sovereignty means. Yeah.
Maybe we can continue with our round.
One thing that I think is important in this discussion is a certain element of pragmatism. I think that there's a lot of discussion about what, you know, peace means and that sort of thing, but I think one of the reasons that it's very difficult for that to be actualized is because there's so much talk of global peace or of, you know, all the billions of people on Earth all, you know, like, singing Kumbaya together, whatever. But that's not very practical, certainly in the short term, you know, that everyone's just going to switch like that from being, you know, at war with one another to being, you know, all right with one another. So I think that I agree that it's a sort of a proposal or like a possibility of what the future could look like. But in order to get there, it's not, I don't know, I think one of the reasons that, you know, peace advocates and that sort of thing tend to get slightly disregarded is that it's such a, you know, such a big goal that, you know, achieving that overnight or in one person's lifetime is, you know, basically impossible. I mean, look at the effort it took to get, you know, women's rights or civil rights or that sort of thing, and, you know, within the context of, like, global peace, that's, you know, relatively minor. So I think that being practical about things is
Kant
important.
Being practical?
In proposing this, probably not. I think that it's such a huge thing. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that you can propose something that's creative and that's slightly fantastical, maybe. That's a good thing. I mean, if people didn't have imaginations about that sort of thing, nothing, you know, no progress would ever be made.
What
in that
is
direction.
Impractical about his proposals? Because he makes very concrete proposals. Like for Aaron, apparently, I understand you, it's fantastic and fantastical to have this idea of abolish armies,
yeah.
Or at least standing armies.
Okay, well, it's like one example of that is so chemical weapons, like smallpox and that sort of thing. The U.S. and the USSR still have, like, samples of all those diseases because they're not willing to destroy them completely based on the fear that the other nation might still have them and choose to use them at some point. So, you know...
But they're not using them.
Yeah, and that's certainly a step in the right direction, but I think going from not using, like, one type of very deadly chemical weapon to abolishing standing armies altogether is a huge leap. And so I think that it has to be taken in a much broader context than it might be.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that in terms of... I mean, if you look at the world of 1795 and at our world where we have mechanisms of international law, we have the United Nations, we have regional organizations like the European Union, like the Organization of American States, you have NAFTA in this continent, you have NATO. Do you think these are examples of multilateral cooperation, a little bit like it was envisaged by Kant? He talks about this idea of that states need to cooperate with each other. Was he wrong in that? Was he predicting something that actually has been taking place, or do you think
predicting peace in the
predicting first of all predicting that states would come to such agreements, and secondly, do these agreements and do these institutions advance peace? Does it make sense that we have the United Nations, or are they just empty superficial organizations without any meaning?
I think they certainly have meaning. I think that there's, again, sort of like, if you take the time into account, that it takes a long while for things to be created and then to gain importance. You know, the WTO is only created in 1995, and that's clearly very effective, and it's like done a lot of things, but I think that there is a correlation between, like globalization and all these different institutions, the UN, NATO, whatever, and a decrease in violence, or maybe an increase in peace, depending on how you look at it.
So there is a correlation.
I think so, yeah. I mean, if you look at, there are certainly more reasons not to go to war with another country, based on all those things, whether it's economic or whether in the EU, it's like an immigration thing. If, a number of your family members come from a bunch of different parts of the world or Europe or that sort of thing, I think there are many more disincentives to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is an instance where commerce does play an important role. On the one hand, it brings people closer together. It also provides us with a mechanism for disciplining nations, like what you were saying about the WTO. Last semester we had to write this essay about how the WTO enforced the rules this happened a few years ago. Do you remember this?
Are we talking about the steel tariffs?
Yeah, the steel tariffs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we have methods besides violence of enforcing compliance.
How about such institution as the International Court of Criminal Justice? I don't know if you've heard, it's a very recent development which would allow a court, and allows a court,
to
the United States are not part of it, which allows a court to basically prosecute also statesmen who have committed atrocious crimes against humanity. Would you think that do you think it's a good idea? Is it an effective tool? And secondly, do you think also American should be part of it and should be subject to such a jurisdiction?
Yeah, I do. I think that there's a huge amount of resistance to that, because that means giving up a certain amount of autonomy or sovereignty, to let yourself be subject to the, something supranational. But I definitely think that that sort of like intertwining of things and having things be more interconnected rather than less definitely promotes peace. In the Roman times, whatever, Caesar could just decide to go to war with the Gauls. He did, because he wanted to. Whereas, the more institutions there are that connect people and countries and that sort of thing, the more and more difficult it becomes to just, go to war or attack or something like that.
So it's like a bureaucratic theory.
I think the economic part also ties into it, pretty heavily, that there are much bigger obstacles to, going to war with a country that you have huge economic ties with.
Everybody's in favor of the U.S. joining the International Court of Criminal Justice. That's interesting.
I don't know enough about it, how it actually regulates within itself and the authority to determine who's committed a crime. And then
it's like a court, like a U.S. court.
And
just
judges are nominated from every country.
Yes, you can. The U.S. has already been. There's the International Court of Justice in The Hague, which is not about crimes against humanity, but it might be something like a border dispute between the U.S. and Canada, and then the U.S. has subjected itself to such a court, and it accepts that kind of ruling. There are human rights mechanisms within the UN and regional human rights mechanisms to which countries subject themselves. And even if their highest court, if the Supreme Court of the US comes to a decision, it might be even overruled by an international body. That's something hard to accept for many Americans as it is for many Europeans.
Also because, like, the Supreme Court in our country sort of, like, makes its decision based on legislation and precedent that sort of ideally sort of, like, reflects the interests of, like, people and the people have, like, shaped the legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just, like, wondering what this body of, like, legislation, the international...
What is it based on?
Yeah,
what
is it
kind
based
of
on?
Absolutely
and,
fascinating
and how
thing.
Would you sort of legitimate that? Because that's a huge to sort of get, an international consensus on, like, a legitimated set of...
I mean, I don't
laws.
Know if anyone of you has taken a course on international law, but that's really a question that what is international law? It is not something like within a state a legislation passed by parliament. It is an established body of norms that come out of custom, sometimes out of treaties, and that nations in their own self-interest agree to abide by. And I think that's one of the absolute principles of this text, and therefore it's been so very influential to argue in favor of that. He says it's necessary for individual states to come to the rule of law within and to create institutions that people respect, and it's absolutely necessary for the international community to create a body of international law to which states are subject to. If you don't have that, you will have a state of instability. And
it is the legacy of this text. That's why it's such a peculiar text. It's a draft. It's a proposal. Perhaps for me, it's a literary practice, but it's also the blueprint by virtue of history for all of these institutional, I think, formations we live with today.
But just to answer concrete, because I said the body of internet, there are conventions usually passed by the United Nations, for example, on genocide, which really define what is genocide and that it's outlawed and it's not good. those are usually the kind of declarations, resolutions by the Security Council that are then the basis of on which these judges, these international judges, then draw their judgments.
Yes, and it just gets tricky. Like, what do you define as, like, a human right and a violation of that? And, like, say, our government deciding to go to war in Iraq be sort of a violation of these? There are all these civilian casualties, and then, like, does that? I feel like, in some sense, like, I feel like part of sovereignty is, like, or, like, you know, we have the ability to go to war, and maybe that shouldn't be the case, but, like, I don't know. I feel like it might undermine sort of individual nations in some sense.
Well, I'll come back to that. It's an interesting question and very important and very, very widely discussed. Do states have the right to go to war?
You were going to say something before.
Yeah, also in a lot of American cases, in American courts, a lot of international issues were raised in the past. So, for example, there was this issue of Nicaragua and the U.S. supporting these rebel groups in Nicaragua. And this person basically went to court, and he used some international laws in an American court. So
yes.
Yes.
So even American courts already apply international norms, but then there are even international mechanisms that supersede them. And
mm-hmm.
just to answer that question, does a country have a right to go to war in international law?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, under certain circumstances, which are well defined, and one of them being the right of self-defense, which is recognized in the United Nations Charter. And another one is if it's authorized by the Security Council. So if there is a collective action of collective security, as it is called, and there have been some wars that the United States has led, which were sanctioned by the UN Security Council and therefore were, so to speak, legal. Whether we agree with that or not, whether there are legal wars or not, or justified wars or not, but the international community has established mechanisms whereby it legalizes the use of force.
I don't know, and I feel like, you know, if we have an international body that allows for that to happen, is it really perpetuating peace? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. This body,
it,
yes.
Is, if it's really effective for perpetuating peace, if there's the ability to wage, like, war within it.
Mm-hmm. And also, I suppose, by the same token, does the United Nations ever take action to declare a war illegal? Or
yes.
And does it do anything to stop those wars?
seldomly, rarely. Sometimes it does. I mean, it has declared the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq, remember, in the first Gulf War, illegal. And then it took action. It authorized not only the United States, is often forgotten. It was a coalition of an international coalition where many also Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, were part of it, were then not only attacking Iraq, but actually it's just simply liberating Kuwait because it was declared an illegal invasion. And that was one instance where the world kind of agreed. And this action was corrected in a sense.
Do you wanna share your definition?
It's very interesting. I think because everyone's said so much about their own personal things about peace, I've just been thinking a lot about agency within countries. I'm just talking about all these international institutions and what that does on a more personal level or within the country. Because I think I've maybe coming up on this like from more of a I guess sociological perspective. But just in terms of there's so many examples of the UN either declaring that something within a country is unjust or unright, whether that's been in Africa, India, where the custom, the norms are different. So I think that is definitely...
Do you have an example? Or?
Well, I think the one thing that I've been studying recently has been like female mutilation, for example. And from a Western perspective, we tend to have this very, strong reaction like that, especially from
women's rights.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like how that, should never be allowed. But then not taking a look at it and saying, well, what are the cultural norms behind it? What are the religious reasons behind it? Which factor into all those decisions. And then trying to break it down onto a more ethical level within the context of it. Because I think if you forget about the context, you can sanction a law, but that doesn't mean that the people are going to follow it, and that's going to probably create more violence within the country than it is going to create peace. So I think more of economic ties, I think, would play a larger role than any type of globalized institution that's going to impose something upon a country, because that can even be viewed as a little imperialistic, I think, especially because the U.S. tends to either go into warfare with a country and say, well, this is what we believe, and we were trying to create peace here, but that doesn't mean that that's, the people in that country, what their perspective is on it, and they don't have any agency to fight back against it.
Mm. I think you put the point on one of the main problems in international relation nowadays is this issue of intervening into other countries' affairs, and I think we've become more and more interventionists and interfering.
And if you keep intervening, that they don't have the infrastructure for when you do leave to hold up anything on their own. It's going to crumble. It's going to fall apart.
Mm.
So I think it's better to, place institutions or help people within the country to create institutions in order for them to build their own infrastructure. And that might not work, but I think that's a more logical way to go about it than, infiltrating a country and saying...
Kant is really saying that one should, under no circumstances, unless one, it makes one exception, intervene into another country's affair. And the one exception is civil war, because then he says the country is kind of losing its sovereignty. It is no longer a country. If it breaks apart, and then it is right for other countries to intervene, which is an interesting concept. I'm not sure. I mean, I think Kant would agree with you. I don't in this thing. I'm not sure if and that may be because of our experience, the experience of Europe in the 1990s, which when I was 10 years younger and. Or 20 years younger, and I saw every day the international community not doing anything while the Bosnians were massacred.
Mm. I think there's a difference between keeping silence and just watching it from afar.
No, when people were not silent, they were watching
and
they were saying it was wrong. But
I thought
they should come and stop it, because people were killed. And I was in favor of military action, which in the end came. At the very end, NATO intervened, but 100,000 people were dead at that time.
Could you talk more about the difference between keeping silent and watching from afar?
I mean, I think, especially in this day and age, just like with media and YouTube, like I think it's amazing. I think that is going to be one of the largest dialogues that are going to be able to, you know, open up connecting people. YouTube, you can see videos, or there, you know, students in Egypt who are posting their own videos of even whole movies, like short movies that are, you know, very roughly cut, but seeing their own personal experiences or what is happening firsthand to them, as opposed to, you know, a U.S. news crew going in and, you know, showing the chaos and, you know, there being no context of them living there and having that connectedness to their country and their people. Sorry, what was your question? I think, oh, standing afar and from not talking. So I think that there's a large difference from just keeping silence and saying, not either commenting upon an issue or saying more of an isolationist, saying, well, this doesn't involve me. And from people commenting upon it and opening up dialogue about it, but either maybe trying to set up dialogue institutions like you guys are doing, trying to, you know, work with institutions already in place in their countries.
But are there like thresholds where you would argue in favor of the rest of the world intervening into one's country's affairs? Let's say, I don't know, there is a country X, let's not say which one, and people are, there is some ethnic cleansing and a genocide going on. Do you think that we then should just strengthen the opposition or strengthen the, in that case,
right. I mean, I think it's a fine line, definitely. I mean, I'm half Jewish, half Armenian, so there's, you know, genocides on both sides of my family. And I think that, you know, in terms of especially the Holocaust, for example, or the Armenian genocide, the fact that no one did step in and for a long time, you know, is crazy. So I think if something like that's happening, like ethnic cleansing, and especially it's being legitimized by the government, I think that's the main thing that, on an ethical standpoint, you know, especially the systematic cleansing, you know, of any type of people, I think, yeah, in that case, there should be intervention. But I think, I know it's difficult, you know, I think there definitely needs to be some sort of say of between posing a limit of, okay, they need to create their own infrastructure if there's beginning to chaos, and we can't just say, we want democracy in this place. You need to set up institutions to maybe stop the violence and then help them regroup to decide to create leaders from themselves of, say, what are we going to do next?
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely think if there's something such as that going on, especially being legitimized by the government, that should be stopped.
Which originates by the government, which is even more often.
Right,
because,
exactly.
What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just in terms of like maybe like you talked about thresholds and like this goes back maybe to like just interference and like legal war and like I think if there is going to be an interference, there needs to maybe be like some sort of international consensus or like legitimated interference in terms of like an international body of law.
Which might be the Security Council or the United Nations.
So I don't know if the Security Council, like, it's pretty, like, small and limited, and I feel like that, I feel like their decisions might not be viewed. One of the things that Kant talks about is that, like, in treaties, oftentimes there are sort of people who hold back and they still have these resentments, and I think it's really important that when you come to these decisions that it be as close to a consensus as possible, and if you have something like the Security Council saying, okay, this is all right, a lot of people might not feel represented in the Security Council. And
does consensus work among you? I mean, this is because it doesn't work in the European Union, so I'm very fascinated that you have it, that it's such an important principle. So you reach decisions by consensus, I understand.
Quasi-consensus.
Yeah, like certain parts of the school, like the admissions office, has to come to consensus on every kid that they like accept or reject, which sounds terrible to me, but I don't know.
Yeah, in the sense that at the school, the way it works, like during plenary, which is the meeting where you have, it's basically majority rule in a sense, where it's direct democracy, but in a way it's not consensus because the grievances that one individual is like expressing, depending on their strength and personality, at a certain point, no matter how strong they feel, there will be so much pressure against them that they'll internalize them and just shut up. And so I think that that's one of the inevitabilities when it comes to large groups of people with differing opinions and the idea of trying to reach consensus, is that there will be so much pressure socially.
Peer pressure.
Yeah. That no matter what you actually believe, you will act in the way that you'll not no longer be like prosecuted by everybody else within your community.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody want to say something about that? I have a different question, but I don't want to interrupt the conversation.
Before we jump to consensus, just about not the conversation shift. I mean, about going into different countries and what that means, and I think that. Maybe a place to start is simply by, I don't think that there's often a lot of resistance to jumping into these conflicts, but at the same time, when it's not an issue of genocide or something nearly on that scale, there's an eagerness to jump in and be patriotic. And I guess I think that maybe a good place to start and a simpler place to start is just changing the way that we do that. And there's a really interesting piece of legislation right now that's a bill to create a cabinet-level Department of Peace. And when you say it that way, it sounds just completely too idealistic to be true or accepted. But I think that one really interesting part of that legislation is how it talks about the military and the role of the military. And actually, there are a lot of people within the military who are really supportive of this. And part of what would happen would be that there would be a U.S. Academy of Peace in Washington that would be completely devoted to peace research and a peace force, and the military would be completely trained culturally in, not completely, because that's kind of impossible, but if the U.S. was sending troops into any country, they would, and if it was in the name of peace or whatever they like to pretend they're trying to do, the very interactions with civilians would be completely different, because they would be culturally trained and, able, I guess, to better. I'm really not doing justice to what it talks about.
This is a very good idea, and I think that that could also be problems, not only to prevent wars in the Kantian sense, but if you think you have to do it in a way that doesn't make things much worse, and to train the U.S. military in civilian cooperation as a project, I think if it had done before, I think the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan would have gone maybe differently.
The change within our military when Petraeus was given basically the total control over Iraq, and when he implemented a policy that was focused around protecting civilians and engaging, no longer driving by in Humvees, but engaging on the ground and patrolling areas, that's when you actually saw that, dramatically better. And then also, along with that strategy, it allowed another group to actually connect to the United States, and then it ultimately is the reason that Iraq has a quasi-functional government with relatively less sectarian violence.
I know that we don't have much time left, so I thought maybe we could do one kind of sort of experiment. And we've been trying to define peace. We've each done it in very different ways. Of course, when one talks about terminologies and language, one's always defining something in opposition to something else or in association with something else. So clearly, the framework for this project was to think about peace in relationship to or not in relationship to war, in part. Lately, for me, the one word that I would think about when I think about peace is the word complicity.
and the way that we're often complicit in society, whether economically or in other ways, with institutions and practices and wars that we ourselves may not necessarily believe in. So I was wondering if we could each go around the room and just throw out, maybe without any explanation, just this one word that maybe we would be thinking about ourselves in relationship to peace or in opposition to it. So for me, again, the word is complicity at the moment. Do you want to go?
I guess it's been talked about a lot, but communication.
Compromise.
I need a few minutes.
Respect.
Cooperation.
Optimism.
I was inspired by you in one of you said, was touched by this comment of manlyhood, of that war is a manly thing. So I would like to know the opposite word of manly. It's probably not womanly, but
gender neutral.
Gender neutral. this is the first time that somebody has put that into context, and that it's a manly affair. So maybe gender neutrality or gender consciousness could be helpful in when discussing matters of peace.
I'd say communication, but I think communication through media.
Education. Commitment.
Forgiveness.
Empathy.
Respect also.
Promise.
Very, very beautiful. This was the third and last workshop we continued. They all went into completely different directions, which I personally learned a lot, not only about Kant, and can never learn enough about this text and about this great philosopher. I learned a lot about peace. I learned a lot about this institution, this great institution, I have to say. It has to be great if it... if there are so many interesting students studying at it. In one of the workshops, people were actually discussing a lot whether Haverford College was a bubble of peace or whether it was the opposite, whether it was an oppressive place, which I thought was great, because I think if everybody would have told me it was the best place in the earth, then I would have gotten worried. So I think you all did a really great job. I think there must be something really great about this institution, that it makes all of you think. I think thinking and being induced to think, and not just to repeat things one learns, is one of the big goals of philosophy. It doesn't arrive often at conclusions. It arrives usually at questions, as Aaron said before. A lot of new questions have been brought up by you for this project, which we think is also Immanuel Kant's project, and I want to congratulate you and thank you for this participation.